You're listening to PorchDrinking.com's The Porchcast, brought to you by OnTap Credit Union. They listen carefully to your needs and make sure you have the right services, low-cost loans, and expert financial advice for you, your business, and your employees. Whatever your needs may be, tap into the services at OnTap Credit Union. And now, The Porchcast. All right, everybody, and welcome to episode 67 of The Porchcast. We are kicking off the year once again here at the Big Beers, Belgians, and Barley Wines Festival up here in Breckenridge, Colorado. Welcome. My name is Tristan. I am your co-host along with Sammy Hartman here and Sam Lail. Good to be back, guys. Welcome. Happy New Year. And we're happy to be joined this episode by the venerable John Hall, one of the most esteemed beer writers, beer journalists of our age. He is the author of Drink Beer, Think Beer, Getting to the Bottom of Every Pint, the American Craft Beer Cookbook. And he's also, he's everywhere now. He's got the Beer Edge newsletter, which we'll get into a little bit here in a little bit, and as well as Drink Beer, Think Beer, the podcast, and Steal This Beer podcast, and many, many more accolades. He's written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. John, is there anything that you don't do?
Sleep enough and spend enough time with my kid. It's the gig economy, and I seem to have all of the gigs right now. I feel that. It's a very nice intro. Thank you very much. Absolutely. None of that is earned or deserved on my part, but I appreciate
it
very much.
Yeah, well. Too humble. Well, we're very very excited to be joined by you, and we definitely want to talk a little bit about the general state of the industry.
Yep.
I love hearing your insights about independent beer journalism, but you know, for those who aren't maybe as familiar with your writing and of your work, I always love to hear how you got into craft beer in general. So why don't we start there?
Yeah, it was by accident, actually. So I was a real newspaper reporter for a lot of years. I was at the Times and spent about 10 years or so, and I got to travel around quite a bit, not only my region, but different parts of the country. And I got to travel quite a bit in my 20s, my early 20s. And what I found very early on, especially as a young reporter, was if you're in a new place, always go find like the best place to eat.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're staying at, you know, the hotel bar, and like the food is usually pretty grim at hotel bars, or at least was like 20 years ago, right? That if I found a local brewery, and most of the time 20 years ago they were brew pubs, like the model for the brew pubs was, let's make a really good burger, or let's make some really good fish and chips, or let's make something that is like, you know, food wise that'll bring people in, and then let's push them on our amber ale and our Hefeweizen and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so like I would just go because like I knew I'd get a good burger somewhere, and it was local and it was nice to support that kind of thing. And then I just started talking to brewers and learning about the process and would have time to kill, and I slowly started to write about it. And then when the newspaper industry sort of blew up in 2008 along with everything else, I started thinking about like, well, what do I want to write about? And up until that point, it had been crime and politics and breaking news and general like environmental
really
issues and
things. Stuff.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, you know, I loved it though, and I love journalism, and I love the thrill of the chase of like getting a good story and the competition, and I still do. And I think it's, you know, like I'm excited about where things are headed in beer right now, but it's or beer journalism. But so then I started writing some books, and I started writing some articles about beer, and then I got tapped to be the editor of All About Beer magazine, which was weird. I was 33 at the time, and then that magazine unfortunately closed due to poor ownership, not because of the state of the industry, but really just poor ownership. Mm-hmm. And then I went and I worked for some other magazines and some other places, and now, you know, I'm sort of hanging my own shingle. And I think after years of sort of being around and covering the entrepreneurial spirit, you know, if you asked me 20 years ago, like, would you ever want to have your own thing? I don't know if I would have been able to imagine that. I've always sort of been a company guy. I've always been, you know, proud to be affiliated with all of the places that I've ever worked. You know, mm-hmm. if my byline has appeared in there, if I've been on the masthead, I've always been really excited to be a part of that place, and to, you know, support that as much as I can. But everything has sort of changed, and to be around these entrepreneurs who are in the same boat. They had worked at other breweries, or they had worked for their own maltsters, or you know, other people. Now they're doing their own thing. It's a terrifying thing to do this, but it's also, given the way that things are these days, it's also sort of, I think, the smart route. And I can, you know, it's sink or swim for all of us.
So do you feel like the kind of startup mentality and entrepreneurial spirit of craft beer kind of helped to influence your decision to kind of focus more on getting out on your own a little bit?
I think a lot of, not necessarily like the beer industry, mm-hmm. but the people who chose to take a jump or chose to take a risk. And I've spent a lot of time in the last 15 or so years covering beer, you know, talking to people and always just sort of asking the question of, you know, when did you know you were ready or when did you know, you know, and in some cases people were pushed and I can certainly relate to that right now, but like, and, or in other cases it was, you know, they got into it and all along they were going to, I'm going to learn as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm always, the end goal was always for them to open up their place. That was never my end goal. But when, you know, faced with situations like that's where I wound up and it's, you know, but I think about a lot of those conversations of people who decided to hang their own shingle, and the reasons that they wanted to do it and what they wanted their business to represent. And mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's, you know, and it's not just beer, like, because you, if you think about like the bar owners that we talk to and you think about, you know, the individual growers that we talk to and the farmers that we talk to, there's a lot of just bootstrapping that takes place in and around beer. That's not just beer manufacturers.
Yeah. I know even in your most recent podcast with Linus from Yazoo, you know, he was talking about how when they were getting started, when they were launching Yazoo, his pitch to restaurants was, you know, we're small businesses just like you trying to make, you know, make a living. Please take a chance on us because we're wanting to take a chance on you. And so I think that really resonates. And I think that's in many cases, the stories all across the country for craft beer.
So, 100%. Yeah.
Now, I want to get into a little bit about the Drink Beer, Think Beer podcast. That's, you know, kind of something that I've really been drawn to over the past, you know, couple months.
Yeah, about a month and a half or so, I guess.
Yeah, a month and a half. For those who haven't explored it, you know, please do check it out on iTunes, all the listening devices.
Yeah,
John does a tremendous job each week to profile different people within the industry. And I think that's kind of leads to my next question is, What's more interesting to you, discovering some of the offbeat kind of stories, or in the case with Drink Beer, Think Beer, you know, meeting these personalities within craft beer? Because, you know, I've read a lot of your work over the past years. You know, I love stuff like reading about the cool ship that was in an El Camino.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun story.
Motorworks Brewing down in Florida. But it seems like you have such a great rapport when it comes to talking with personalities in the industry.
Thanks. I enjoy doing the podcast. And one of the things is it's not so much about the personalities, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm fortunate that I've been covering the industry for a while that if, you know, my byline, I guess, is a little known and I can call up brewers that are in the first name club, you know, Sam, Jim, et cetera, you know, Matt, and say, you know, hey, would you sit down with me? And hopefully they know the type of journalism that I've done and that they know that it'll be, you know, worth their time,
yeah.
you know, and that's the thing. There's, Jose Diaz-Balart is a journalist on NBC and, he hosts the NBC Nightly News on the weekends and his sign off, is, thank you for the privilege of your time. Mm-hmm. And I really love that. And it's something that I've always really, it's been instilled in me at a young age as a reporter as well of, it's a privilege when people sit down and talk with us, you know, like it's not a given, you know, there's no good reason that anybody should have to sit down with us unless like we've earned it. And then if they do sit down with us, you know, make it worth their time, make it feel like they didn't waste the 45 minutes, an hour, the five or so hours that I spend with people when I'm doing these things or any, for any article. So, you know, for me, it doesn't necessarily have to be about the personality. You know, because sometimes just because somebody is famous or well-known doesn't mean that they're interesting.
Absolutely.
So for me, I really like the unsung heroes. And it doesn't have to be about, you know, well, how'd you get started? Or, you know, like, what's your favorite beer style? Or things like that. It's, you spend a little time with them beforehand or reading about them. And you say, okay, this person is really passionate about saisons. Or
sure.
this person, you know, geeks out over lacto, you know, or like whatever it is. And then you just dive into
that. In the case of Matt Brinelson,
sure,
beer foam.
Beer foam. You know, and you just have to sort of roll with it and hopefully know that you know enough about the subject matter to fake your way through it. But like, especially live on tape. But for those guys, it is, if you can find mine a vein that is interesting to them, you're going to be left with a better conversation. They're going to feel better. They're also going to enjoy talking more and the podcast is going to sound better. And then the listener is going to hopefully enjoy it that much more. So,
sure.
you know, that's always been my approach as a journalist is it's my job to sit here, hopefully ask interesting questions and then, you know, take the conversation wherever the person wants to take it, because like I'm on their time. Mm-hmm. And that to me is, you know, what I've been trying to do with this podcast. And quite honestly, the other interview podcast that I've done in the past, for All About Beer, I did one. And then for the other magazine, I did one. And, you know, like it was fun. And it was, you know, like I enjoy these conversations. Like sure. This is, you know, it's a fun reason to get out of bed hungover in the morning to sit down with folks.
Absolutely. Now, you know, one thing that strikes me, and we talked a little bit about this before this interview.
Yeah.
Was, A, you know, clearly your stuff is extremely well researched, which I think it lends to a lot of what you were talking about of, you know, finding that tie into the person, the offbeat, the something that they're passionate about. But what also strikes me in a lot of these interviews is the fact that you are able to go to speak with them in person. And, you know, in a sense, you're surrounded by that terroir.
Yeah.
With Matt Brinelson, you went out to Belgium. You were out in Nashville talking to Linus from Yazoo. You were out. I know with Lauren Salazar, you guys were out in New York, but you guys were out while they were doing their big campaign. And so, how much of that enhances the podcasting experience? How much does that influence kind of your conversations, I guess?
I like going and being on somebody's turf.
Yeah.
Or at least being out in the world as well. It gives you a pretty good insight into the person that you're interviewing as well. And it also, it helps sort of form for me, even before we start recording, where the conversation is going to go. So in the case of the Yazoo podcast, you know, I show up and Linus opened the door for me at the side of the brewery, you know, near his CO tanks and CO2 tanks, and like, you know, like walked me through this brand new brewery, and he pointed out a few things. We walked through the tap room, and like, you know, like he was showing me all of these things, the new touches and things that they were going to be doing. And, you know, there's this real sort of sense of pride.
Yeah.
And that sort of helps form the conversation as well of like, all right, like you really care about the brush that you're clearing out so that we can see views of the river. So like maybe we'll talk about that or at least acknowledge it at some point or something. We're here at the Big Beers Festival. I've done a couple, for my show here. We're sitting in a hotel room, you know, like yeah. We're sitting in the lobby.
Sure.
I think that's sort of, you know, that's fun as well. Cause like we're out of our element. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit weird. I think it doesn't necessarily matter where you talk to people as long as the conversation is solid. But I do think that, when you're able to convey sense of place or terroir, I think it does help. Sure. The overall richness of the conversation.
Awesome. Now, you brought up big beers.
Yeah.
It's something that we always like to impart on our listeners when we get a chance to record up here. You've been up here for about 7 years, right?
Yeah, I think this is year 7.
That's awesome.
Six or seven, maybe.
Tell us a little bit about kind of the place of this festival in the grand landscape of craft beer festivals or events. Because this is really, you know, I like to tell people that have never heard of it that this is one of the more unique festivals in the country.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best festivals in the country, hands down. And for the purposes of full disclosure, I am a board member of Big Beers. So Laura Lodge, who founded this festival 20 years ago,
totally.
A couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago, decided that it, you know, it's the nonprofit, that there needed to be a board of directors to help her, you know, guide everything in the right way. And I was still the editor at All About Beer, and she asked me to sit on the board, which I was honored to do, and even still to this day. So when I'm being effusive in my praise of this, yes, it is as a board member, but it's also, I was coming up here for years as a, sure. as a fan and as a beer drinker as well. The thing that I like about Big Beers, and this isn't to knock other festivals, but like, if you go to one that's at a stadium parking lot, or if you go to one that's in a huge cavernous convention center, mm-hmm. or if you go to one that is whatever, you know, there is sometimes a lack of intimacy, and there's sometimes just a, it becomes a destination for just a few hours.
Sure.
Big Beers is a weekend long event. Yeah. The big thing is obviously the Saturday commercial tasting, which is 4 hours of people drinking 12% pastry stouts and barley wines and quads and, you know, and then somehow managing
John
to go
like
out. Oh God!
It's just space right now.
I mean, by the time five, no, I'm not dreading it, but by the time 5 o'clock rolls around, I need a lager.
Yeah.
Just, a glass of water.
Yeah, a glass of water and a nap and Advil.
I feel like one of these years we're gonna evolve to the point where people unexpectedly just all bring table beers, Belgian table beers.
Yeah. I would love it. I mean, that's sort of like the thing about it. But it's everybody's just trying to, you know, do their 12% whatever.
Yeah.
But it starts on Thursday, and there's, you know, welcome receptions, and the town of Breckenridge, where it is now, it used to be in Vail, you know, is really welcoming. There's some cool bars, and brewers come in, and they do tap takeovers, and there's this real sort of sense of community. You know, it's a few thousand people probably that are here, but we're contained on a mountain. We're contained in a ski town, you know, so this is, the town is the destination, and you're here for the whole weekend, hopefully, and so it's not just, I'm going to come in and try to get blasted in 4 hours of a commercial tasting. It's, I'm going to sit at the pop-up bar for the Falling Rock and have, you know, some beers and talk with people, or I'm going to go down to a restaurant and, like, actually have, like, a meal. Like, people actually, like, eat real food at these things, like, which is nice. They go to restaurants and, like, are civilized. And there's dining components to this festival as well, with the brewmaster dinners and the small plates and all these other fun things.
And
the educational seminars as well. Like, if you come up here, when you leave, I think you're more enriched as a beer consumer, a beer fan, a beer drinker. And even the brewers, I think, leave with a fun sense of camaraderie. You know, it's a lot to ask, you know, a hundred or so brewers to come early in January, you know, to a ski mountain and to, you know, fly and, you know, come from around the country for this. But I also think that they like to just kind of hang out. Like, if you walk around, it's not uncommon at, you know, 10 o'clock at night to see hot tubs full of, you know, brewers in the First Name Club, you know, just like all sitting around. And it's weird, but it's, you know, but they're friends as well. And it's a chance for them to connect. And the fact that this fest has been around for 20 years and the industry has changed so much in the last two decades, this has built a foundation of what I think a lot of people have the ideal of what they want craft beer to be.
Absolutely.
And this is personified as opposed to like what actually happens in the real world where it's, you know, fractured and fighting and check-ins and everything else in between.
And I think it's a testament too that, you know, for this 20th anniversary, you have so many big names and so many big breweries that are, you know, so willing and generous with their time to come out and reunion. You know, tonight is the big 20-year reunion event, and you've got a veritable who's who of craft beer coming, reconvening for this special occasion. So I think it really is special, and I think it's beautiful what Laura and Bill have built over the years.
100%. I couldn't agree with that more.
Special thanks to our show sponsor, OnTap Credit Union. With locations in Golden and Arvada, OnTap Credit Union has supported brewery employees for over 64 years. They listen carefully to your needs and make sure you have the right services, low-cost loans, and expert financial advice for you, your business, and your employees. Whatever your needs may be, tap into the services at OnTap Credit Union. That's www.ontapcu.org.
Now, it's been, you know, one thing when I get together with someone who's as studious about the industry is I love hearing about your perspective about the past couple of years. And I know this leads into
what a century the last couple of years has been.
Exactly. Leads into dangerous territory. But, you know, last year in particular was a huge year for beer. We saw the Sam Adams and Dogfish Head merger at the beginning of the year. We saw New Belgium and Little Lion World /Curin at the end of the year. Ballast Point also kind of a big surprise with the Kings and Confics acquisition. You also had the Founders litigation. So a lot of different aspects of craft beer news that all kind of were this insane confluence of things. What do you think of those, or maybe something that we didn't mention, has the biggest impact for the future of the industry?
I mean, the consolidation, I think, was inevitable
at
some point. And it's increasingly harder for the larger breweries in the quote unquote craft space, to be viable. The rise of the tap rooms over the last 5 years has been nothing short of cataclysmic in the way that, it's disrupted the industry. You know, people talk about like disruptors, you know, the tap room model where you have somebody who makes 800 barrels a year, you know, can be clearing, you know, huge margins, you know, just because people show up to drink their IPA or drink their pale ale or drink whatever is off of their food or like whatever and are not then going to the grocery store and buying, you know, Ballast or New Belgium or Dogfish or whatever. You know, that has really changed the industry in a huge way.
Sure.
You know, and the larger that some of these breweries got, I'm not saying we lost a lot of what craft is, but it, when I talk about like being here at Big Beers, that this is the ideal, this is like the sense of community that doesn't exist in the real world anymore.
Sure.
And those largest, like, let's just take like the 25 largest, you know, craft brewers in the U.S., which includes, you know, I'm pretty sure Dogfish is in that number. I think they're 22 or thereabouts. But sure. Brooklyn's up in there, and, you know, Bell's is up in there, and New Belgium is up in there, and all of these other breweries, Sam Adams. they're all competing at the local bars for tap handles. They're competing in the Kroger and the Safeway and the every other place for shelf space. And so are the small guys as well, because some of these grocery stores are like, yeah, we'll take a pallet of Outer Range, or we'll take a pallet of Ratio, or we'll take a pallet, like, you know, if there's room for it, because like those stores recognize the diversity as well. So I think the consolidation was bound to happen. And there's smart things where New Belgium, like, they just needed to sell. Like, it was the time, you know, for them to do this. And people who were surprised, like, I'm, you know, understand that you were surprised, but it's also a business decision. You know, the Sam Adams Dogfish Head, I saw that as a really strong strategic move. You know, it helps them out. You know, Sam Adams has become a beverage company. They make a lot of Truly Hard Seltzer. They make a lot of Angry Orchard. They make a lot of Twisted Tea. Mm-hmm. Boston Lager is still popular, and Summer Ale still does really well for them. But when you look at their overall portfolio, they've never really had a lot of success with IPAs or, you know, quick sours. And what does Dogfish Head do really well? IPAs and quick sours.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they also needed a
piece right there.
Yeah, and they needed a rescue line, and, you know, and it was important for Sam Calagione, Mariah Calagione, and their staff to stay quote unquote independent. Mm-hmm. And so they found the right partner, you know, to sort of help them keep their designation.
At the end of the day, I think that it's really hard for consumers not to take it personally. You know, that they feel so dedicated and so loyal to a brand, and then when they see something like a sale, they're like, well, that's obviously that's a personal affront towards me as a consumer, but it is, it's business, you know? You want all of these people to continue to succeed, and I think it's hard for a consumer to separate, you know, the fact that it is still just beer, I guess.
Yeah, and do you all feel that's a societal kind of cultural thing that people, you know, because it's weird, you know, in technology, it's natural.
Yeah.
It's, in the tech scene, it's natural for acquisitions to happen. In fact, it's often encouraged for you to be able to get acquired, you know, Series A funding or whatever. But
you strive for it.
Yeah, you strive
for it. I mean, that's, yeah.
But in craft beer, it's different. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just sort of the conditioning early on that it was this intimate product where you could walk in and you could meet the person, mm-hmm. you know, who's doing it. You know, we're not all meeting the people who make our iPhones or our, you know, yeah. Ford Escapes or
right.
anything
there's
else
a
in
detachment.
Between. Yeah, there. I mean, so there's an attachment to it. But also the same people, like, let's be honest, the same people who take to the internet and scream and yell and feel really betrayed by a brewery like New Belgium, you know, and these are like the real loud rabble rousers, right? The keyboard warriors. When was the last time they bought and drank a full six-pack of Fat Tire?
Absolutely.
Right. Oh, 100%.
It's probably 1% of the actual consumer base.
And that's the thing. But they're still selling a lot of Fat Tire, and mm-hmm. the people who are doing it will probably still continue to drink mm-hmm. Fat Tire.
Yep.
And, like, so good on them, you know? I mean, there's some great things that are coming out of the Wood program there, but, like, it's a business decision
business.
At the end of the day. And those employee owners of New Belgium, like, you know, the stories have come out that, you know, some of them will get, you know, some really nice money, and they'll be able to do some nice things. And
sure.
I think that's a nice thing as well, you know? And isn't that sort of important as well? I mean, you all know people who work in breweries. Like, it's not a lucrative thing for a lot of people.
No,
so
no.
If you can get a couple of extra bucks in your pocket and still keep your job, like, that's kind of a win for those people who have put so much blood, sweat, and tears into it. But
totally.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to kind of play devil's advocate
okay.
here for a second and ask, you know, you mentioned that it has become a little bit of a necessity for these. And I would agree, for the top, you know, 10 breweries by volume, it's become a competitive shelf space kind of field. But, you know, I was struck. I attended CBC this past year when I was in Denver and heard Natalie from Russian River talking about how if she had it her way, they would remain this 15,000 barrel brewery for the rest, you know, for the rest of their existence. Do you think, you know, there's always going to be a need for small, you know, microbreweries that are, you know, neighborhood breweries, nano breweries, those are always going to thrive on their own. But do you find that is there a place for a 15,000 barrel brewery to continue to exist in its kind of state in the current landscape of craft beer?
Yeah, I do. You know, because they're regional players. It is that sense of place as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I love when I travel, To Northern California drinking Russian River because I can't get it where I live.
Sure.
You know, and I think that was sort of like, you know, the rose was off the bloom a little bit, even with New Belgium. Like when they came into New Jersey 2 years ago where I live, you know, like I had a fat tire at my local bar and I was like, this is really cool. And then I didn't have one again because, like, you know, so I think some of those regional breweries, you know, especially if they have a sense of place and like they're making fun and great beer, I think that that's really cool. And I don't think we're going to see too many more of that because, you know, the taproom model exists in a certain way, but like, yeah, if you can go to a local Safeway or whatever and see a beer that you can't get one state over if you're traveling, or, you know, and I also think that there's also a sense of local pride as well. You know, I think of, you know, Jay Brooks, the writer, he lives close to Russian River, and every time he travels, he goes to the brewery beforehand and buys, you know, like fresh six packs of Pliny and then brings it with him and like hands them out as gifts. And people are like, gobsmacked by this, and it's awesome because it's like this, it's big enough where people know it, and it's great enough beer that people know it, and it's a fun thing. Like, can't get it where I live, and it speaks into that, you know, that rare sort of culture just on a larger scale.
Totally. Now, in looking forward to the next decade, you know, we've got the seltzer craze, we've got low-cal really starting to gain momentum. Hazy, you know, it's CBD, THC. The verdict's still out on whether those will have any impact. Do you see any of those, or do you see any other trends having the sustainability in terms of staying power of hazy IPAs, or any bold predictions in terms of what's next for craft beer?
Man, I love these questions because, you know, the cop-out answer is, you know, if I had a crystal ball, I would, I don't know if any of us actually saw hazy becoming what hazy became.
Sure.
You know, I mean, like when it first started to really hit, when I was at All About Beer, you know, I think I asked Ken Weaver to write a story, or maybe Jeff Allworth, either one of them like wrote a story on it, like early on.
Yeah.
And I was like, why are we doing this? And I was like, I don't know. I'm just seeing it like pop up, you know? And like, it was around the same time that, you know, it might have been Brian Roth wrote a story about, you know, Black IPA, Cascadian Dark. And, you know, where's that? And, you know, and I've written articles about, you know, about Brood IPA in the past. And like, where's that these days? Like, you never know, like, what's going to hit, what's going to resonate.
Sure.
And go from there. But I do think the trends that we've seen are sweeter, low-cal, you know, speaks to sort of our, you know, sugar-minded brains, but also fitness these days, you know? I mean, when I'm talking to brewers these days and they are just casually dropping into conversation how many calories are in a can of their beer, that's something that didn't happen a year and a half ago.
No.
But it's happening frequently now because they're realizing that that's what. So I think we're going to see that trend continue of, you know, trying to extol the health benefits. I think we'll probably see a rise in the non-alcoholic space as well. You know, when you look at the average craft beer drinker, you know, there's a lot of young drinkers in 22, 23, 25 year olds who are drinking, you know, full bottles of pastry stout and everything. That's really cool. Like, but you know, I turn 40 tomorrow and like that is not something that I can do anymore or ever did. So I'm looking at ABVs first, you know, and I'm looking at the non-alcoholic space because I want to keep drinking. I want to still be part of the party. But some of these non-alcoholics that I've had, like, they're pretty good. And I can just have one as I'm standing around and sitting with people and it goes from there. So like, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see a return to, me selfishly, a return to base styles. I'd love to see more English milds on, you know, I'd love to see more barrel-aged stouts that are not adjuncted to hell, you know, and
that's one of the things that I actually noted in my preview of this piece is one of the things that I'm most excited about is trying some of these beers that have taken non-adjunct stouts but have focused more on a different blend of barrels.
Yeah.
That's something that I am really curious about. I know Weldworks does a tremendous job of that already. You know, this year's Utopias, for example, saw, I think, five different barrels, different kinds of barrels, spirit barrels.
Is it that many? Jesus.
I don't know. It's going to be a wild world in terms of barrel aging, and hopefully we can, you know, still showcase the barrel instead of throwing in a bunch of adjuncts. So.
But it also comes, I think, with time, right? Like, I'm talking to a lot of these brewers these days, and like, they're now 10 years old, 15 years old, 20 years old, and they've gone through their adolescence. Like, they've gone through their, I'm going to grow a mullet, I'm going to get a Trans Am, I'm going to, you know, like, whatever. And, you know, and now they're like, you know, well, I got a haircut and I drive a minivan and my kids to school. Like, they've grown up a little bit. But I think
ESB.
But I also think that their beer has evolved as well, where they're going back and looking at the process again and looking at the raw ingredients and saying, like, all right, cool, like, I remember zesting, you know, 900 pounds of oranges and throwing them into a barrel, or, you know, like, we toasted coconuts forever and we threw them into a barrel. Let's just see what the barrel does, and let's learn about the barrel first. Like, let's take it apart and, you know, like, run analytics on it, because we have a lab now that can sort of tell us, like, what's growing in this, and then let's build a recipe around that. And, like, let's – there's a lot more science that's coming into it. There's a lot more thought that's coming into it, as opposed to just, like, knee-jerk thought, or, you know, let's try to go grab the Instagram headlines or whatever. And so that, to me, is kind of fun, of the thoughtful brewers who are returning us as drinkers to – the basics, and sort of giving us an education again of, like, it's really cool that you love, you know, coconut whatever, but, like, have you ever had a non-adjuncted barrel aged stout? Let's go back and taste that, and then let's go back and taste the coconut and see if your perception has changed a little bit. And I think brewers are, you know, they're educators first and foremost.
Sure.
You know, and that's...
Now, on that note, I think this next question is a little bit nebulous in a sense, but do you feel like, because of this, you know, we've gone through this evolution, do you feel, and but also the fact that we have such innovation happening right now, do you feel like we are in the best era of beer that has ever existed?
Yeah. I mean, there's choice. You know, I can come to Colorado, and every time there's new breweries that have popped up in Denver, or I can go to, you know, a brewery that I've been to, you know, a dozen times before, and, you know, still be delighted and excited. We couldn't do that 15 years ago. We couldn't do that 20 years ago, you know? And it's, yeah, I think it's easy to complain, and I'm one of the first to do it. but I think that there's also just a lot of really fun things to celebrate, and it just comes down to, you know, having a pint with friends and just having a good conversation with people, and just, you know, just remembering, like, why we got into covering it, working for it, making it in the first place. And, you know, we all need perspective these days. We all need a little bit of calm in our lives. We all need just a little bit of, you know, happiness, and beer can provide that. So, you know, yeah, the fact that there's endless choice and passionate people doing it, yeah, this is, you know, I hope it continues to get better, but this is a really great time to be a beer drinker.
No, I like that you took it to a happy place. I might be bringing you back to a darker place
right
now.
Cool.
You know, as turbulent as it has been in craft beer over the past, 10 years, it's also been quite turbulent for independent craft beer journalism.
Yeah, or journalism in general.
Sure.
Journalism in general, certainly. It is under assault these days.
You know, we've seen publications like Draft Magazine, Shudder. We've seen All About Beer. We've seen Beer Pulse. Hop Review just, you know, Wednesday, actually, good friends of ours announced that they were shutting down out of Chicago. And I know they were a smaller publication, but a great one nonetheless.
Yeah.
What do you see for the future of beer reporting? And how can we, I guess, make this a more sustainable industry and one that is, I guess, holding up the ideals that it was kind of founded upon?
So, journalism in general is a tough thing, and the internet has not helped, because there's so many folks who, when the internet first came out, newspapers and magazines were just throwing their stuff up on the website for free and hoping that print advertising would keep them going. And obviously that hasn't happened. And so there's been success stories with, like, the New York Times, and there's been success stories with the Washington Post and the LA Times and a few others. But, like, in the beer space, you know, a lot of the publications didn't make the transition to the internet early enough or monetize it, you know, the right way. And so, you know, some of the beer newspapers like Celebrator or Ale Street, which have been around forever, you know, were reluctant to change. And, you know, Beer Advocate, which I think was doing some great stuff with their print magazine, you know, just didn't make the change, because, you know, their website was driving a lot of their revenue, but then Untappd came on and sort of, you know, that really hurt them, and they didn't change and adapt with the times. So I think that where we are with beer media right now is the people who are still in the space or getting into the space, we have to address the world that we're in right now. Not beer, but journalism. And how do people approach journalism? And then you have to make the case to people saying, I really appreciate the nice words that you say about my work. I really appreciate, you know, that, you know, like you think that what we do is important. I need you to show that through, you know, if it's, you know, Patreon through a couple of bucks, if it's through getting a subscription to, you know, one of the still existing print magazines, which is still important. Like the ones that are still on the newsstands, like you should be supporting those 100%. You know, if it's, you know, a podcast through, you know, Patreon, or if it's through, you know, like listening through the ads on a podcast and not just skipping the 15 seconds through, that helps those of us who are here and who care about journalism, who care about telling good stories, and who care about putting stuff forward. A lot of the time, and so this new thing that I launched with Andy Crouch called Beer Edge, which is a subscription-based newsletter for the industry. Yeah. You know, we're saying, you know, for the price of, you know, like a pint of beer a month, or, you know, not a pint of beer, but, you know, a couple more than that. But, like, you know, like, if you, it's some of the, you know, pennies a day, or, you know, you too can help a starving writer make his mortgage, right? That kind of thing. But that's really what it is. It's not an overall huge commitment. But it also then reinforces in us as journalists that, like, the job that we have is important, and that there's people who care about what we're doing, and it makes us work harder and dig deeper and go, you know, to find the stories, you know, where they are, and to hopefully connect people, you know, to the world, or to expose people to things that, you know, they weren't going to be exposed to, you know, shining light on, you know, the bad side of the industry as well, which exists. You know, and we've seen that. We saw that with, you know, some of the founders coverage this year. You know, there's folks who really led that and did a really good job with that. You know, and there's folks who are doing that in other spaces as well. You know, if it's writing about diversity, or if it's writing about inclusion, or if it's writing about, you know, all of these things that people talk about at situations like here at Big Beer, but that the general public should be aware of every time they have a pint of beer, even if it's in their background. The way to do that is to support the journalists and the publications and the websites that really care about putting out good media and good content. And absolutely, it doesn't have to be a huge financial commitment, and you can find the people that you like. Like, obviously, I would love if people, you know, gave, you know, money to Beer Edge and to keep it going. But if you're gonna, you know, if you decide that you don't like what I'm doing, but you like what somebody else is doing, give them money.
Yeah.
Because that's important too,
as important,
you know, like, cause it's the industry. It's not the individual. It's the industry.
Totally. Well, John, we really appreciate you sitting down with us. Tell the folks who are interested now in, you know, finding out more about Beer Edge and also Drink Beer, Think Beer, how to follow you, and, you know.
Yeah, everything is on beeredge.com, and we have their podcast page, our podcast page on there as well. And I'm on all of the social medias under John Hall, H-O-L-L. I'm not the guy who founded Goose Island all those years ago. I did not get a nice check from AB a couple years ago. Josh Noel did not write a book about me a couple years ago. I hope he will in the future. But so Beer Edge, we're on all of the social medias as well. And I hope people will take a look at what we're doing. And thanks to you guys for what you guys are doing. Like, you guys have been, you know, pushing the Colorado beer scene and the national beer scene forward for what, like 6 years now, is
7 years, yeah.
7 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. And, like, it's the bootstrap thing as well. And it's the new modern media of, you guys are kicking ass and taking names, and I'm honored to sit down with you. Thanks for allowing me.
Well, thanks, everyone. Be sure to follow John Hall. Once again, thebeeredge.com. You can find out all of his information. And thanks for joining us for episode 67 of The Porchcast. Be sure to follow us on all of your listening devices if you liked what you listened to. We'll have more coming from this weekend and beyond. This has been The Porchcast with Sammy Hartman, Sam Lale, and Tristan Chan. We'll check you later.
I like what you're listening to? Be sure to follow The Porchcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and whatever listening devices you may follow. You can also follow Porch Drinking on Twitter and Instagram at @porchdrinkingco.